whatlight.com. www.whatlight.com. That concludes the performance, the premiere of What Light from Darkness Grows. This is WBAI New York. Stay tuned. Coming up at 5 o'clock, we'll be going to the Museum of Television and Radio for a little bit of this.
Speaker, distinguished guests, fellow citizens.
All Mixed Up with Peter Beauchamp.
He'll take care of things.
Saturday afternoons at 5 here on WBAI.
He'll make a way out of no way. He'll open doors that no one can open and shut doors that no one can shut.
I tried to explain that to Aunt Ruth, but the connection was bad and the plane was leaving. And she got it all mixed up.
All Mixed Up with Peter Beauchamp.
French.
Saturday afternoons at 5 here on WBAI.
You should be here with me, babe. You should be here with me, babe.
The time is now 1 minute past 4 o'clock. Now, as regular listeners know, part of the mandate from our national network, Pacifica, is to devote 2 hours per week to discussion of the revisions of bylaws of the Pacifica Foundation. This will be a contrast to what you have just been listening to. This edition of the bylaws revision extravaganza comes to us in mixed and taped form, so we will not be taking calls on these issues, comes to us from our colleagues at WPFW in Washington, D.C. Grab a bowl of popcorn, put your feet up, and start to dance. Bylaws.
Since KPFA went on the air last April 15, 1949, it has had available for its operation from all of the different sources from which it has sought funds a little over $33,000, $33,570.39 to be exact. That's the amount that has been available to KPFA from all sources.
That was Pacifica founder Lou Hill in 1950. Sometimes it seems that the more things change, the more they stay the same. Lou Hill and his compatriots took 3 years to get their license to begin broadcasting from the Federal Communications Commission. The foundation was established in 1946, and Hill and company planned to get an AM license in working-class Richmond, California. What they got instead was an FM license in Upper Crust, Berkeley. This was the birth of community-based radio in the U.S., a radical concept germinated as Lou Hill and other conscientious objectors did time in prison camps during much of World War II. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The following program is an historical accounting of the birth of Pacifica Radio, as told and recalled through the eyes of the men and women who were there in the early beginnings. As the foundation undertakes the task of revising its bylaws and governance structure while conducting democratic elections, we thought it timely to revisit the spirit and the letter of the foundation's mission, as envisioned by Lou Hill and the founders. In the beginning, there was KPFA. Richard Moore, one of Lou Hill's closest friends and a founding member of KPFA, recalls Hill's vision, even in the early days, included dreams of a network.
You know, it's dangerous to talk about visions because you get a little atavistic about that. We did have the notion, and let's say Lou had the notion, of Pacifica being a practice much wider than radio. I mean, we envisaged publishing a magazine, lots of other activities, simply to try and get across the idea of dialogue and nonviolent resolution of disputes.
Intense battle is what kept Pacifica together in the beginning, according to Moore, as well as the sharing of a common culture in an era when the Pacifica community tended to be white, middle-class, educated European Americans. It was the Cold War, McCarthy era, and the House Un-American Activities Committee was scrutinizing KPFA's programming. Pacifica went on the attack, generating this now famous testimony of Sovietologist William Mandel before HUAC.
Are you now, or have you ever been, a member of the Communist Party?
Honorable beaters of children and sadists, uniformed and in plain clothes. Distinguished Dixiecrat wearing the clothing of a gentleman. Eminent Republican who opposes an accommodation with the one country with which we must live at peace in order for us all and our children to survive. If you think that I am going to cooperate with this collection of Judases, of men who sit there in violation of the United States Constitution, if you think I will cooperate with you in any way, you are insane.
KPFA had become a launching pad for political, social, and cultural movements in the country. Poet Lawrence Ferlinghetti, one of the beat poets of the 50s and an early performer on KPFA, says Pacifica was the only place to be heard in the late 50s, and he offers some sincere but unflinching criticism.
Well, it seems as if the present programming some of the Pacifica stations at least contributes to the dumbing down of America, because the cultural level has been lowered enormously throughout the nation, and I'm afraid to have the impression that Pacifica is not fighting that strongly enough. The original mission of KPFA, and I get this from Matthew's book, among other places, was to educate for peace through humanist cultural programming. And then, later on, under attack from the Un-American Activities Committee and other similar types of censorship, the mission became more defense and promotion of free speech. And from there, it went to many other variations. And so today, to ask what is the mission of the station today, this is where it's a big stumbling block today.
Poet Lawrence Ferlinghetti is of the mind that identity politics are confusing the issue of what the mission should be today. In the 50s, poets, now famous poets and writers like Paul Robeson, James Baldwin, and Allen Ginsberg, used their art to further the Pacifica mission.
I have never separated my work as an artist from my work as a human being. I've always put it even more strongly that, to me, my art is always a weapon. It's got to be good art.
Paul Robeson.
If one is going to get an education, if one is going to become what is called an educated man or woman, if I am the teacher, the only way I can help you get this education is to teach you how to think. Thinking is not a luxury. Thinking is not something that embroiders a life. Thinking is what a life, finally, in one way, depends on. But in order to learn how to think, one must be taught to think about everything. There can be nothing that one cannot think about. There can be nothing that one cannot examine. In this country, there's always been something not to think about. And what that was me. Sometimes called Sambo. Sometimes called Uncle Tom. Sometimes a rapist. Sometimes the same. These are your inventions, not mine.
James Baldwin.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness. Starving, hysterical, naked. Dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn looking for an angry fix. Angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient, shuddering connection to the starry dynamo in the machinery of night.
Allen Ginsberg. It was Ginsberg's poem Howl which laid the groundwork or the foundation for the infamous obscenity trials of the 50s. The FCC questioned Pacifica's broadcast of Ginsberg and Ferlinghetti's works as vulgar, obscene, and in bad taste, with strong implications against religion, the government, the president, law enforcement, and racial groups. In the early days of KPFA, programmer Eric Bauersfeld says it was understood that presenting art on the radio is in itself an art form. He alludes to the 1952 book chat show hosted by Kenneth Rexroth from his home.
His program was very unusual. It had in it all, anything that happened around him when he was doing it. You heard a fire engine, you heard the toilet being flushed, a telephone call, burps, anything that was human. And I understand that the engineers and some of the people that you mentioned earlier did either had fun with them by taking out the ums, but the engineers tried to take all the spaces out and all the little things that went in between the words. Years passed, and now the engineers are trying to put them back because it turned out to be a kind of virtual radio reality, realitas, or whatever you call it. And most of the really interesting work in Europe, radio drama, it does that as well. I mean, there's a lot of things being done on location, and they get everything in, and they can alter them, they can change them. But Rexroth was full of these things, and he knew it. And his programs were meant to sound like what they were. They were recordings made at home. And in homes, all the sounds and odd things that happened were part of it. So it was, in a sense, the beginning of a kind of avant-garde art form.
Bauersfeld recalls that the best programs from the previous day's schedule were rebroadcast during the morning and were often scheduled at odd times. Shows beginning at 7:50 or 8:20, for example, allowing program content to take priority over format. He says that the notion that all programming must conform to hour or half-hour time slots is a form of commercializing Pacifica. So, too, is the belief that the schedule was sacrosanct. It was the message, not the medium, that mattered. In fact, an entry in a 1963 folio reads, "Striking a new note, Howard Zinn delivers a speech at the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Conference in Atlanta. Mr. Zinn is a professor of history and social science at Spelman College in Atlanta. The speech was aired at 45 minutes. The prototype of the Pacifica listener activist, Ariel Parkinson, is a painter and theatrical set designer. Ariel and her late husband, Tom, a UC Berkeley professor of literature, hosted the after party for KPFA's maiden broadcast in 1949. She reminisces about the lifestyle of a KPFA listener.
On those early days, I heard Ella Young, an Irish, a Celtic poet, really pre-Irish, Celtic, who happened to be in Berkeley and gave greetings to California, the tawny lioness and the goddesses of Mount Diablo and Mount Tamalpais over the air, and all sorts of, I mean, very unexpected things. We changed our life so that we could listen to children's programs like the reading of Wind in the Willows, a BBC reading, every evening at 5 o'clock for a number of weeks. And so we had three children at that time, two of them belonging to Richard Moore, but just went. And they all came back to listen to The Wind in the Willows. So it was a cultural necessity very fast. It was impeccably diverse. And it had a spectrum that ranged from jazz and the topical music of the hour through Alan Rich doing things in old country houses in England on the original instrument and piping it back to Berkeley for KPFA. So somebody, a socialite, said to me, "Well, that's what I have instead of a husband now, is KPFA."
Years after the maiden broadcast of KPFA, further south in the state of California, KPFK 90.7 FM bellowed onto the airwaves on a commercial frequency. Blessed with an enormous transmitter in a prime location, KPFK was and is today the most powerful of the Pacifica stations and has the strongest signal of all public radio stations in the western United States.
On July 26th,
1959, KPFK became the second leg of the Pacifica Network. It began very humbly in a small building on Melrose Avenue, with the goal of bringing to Southern California free and creative radio without the pressure of commercial advertising.
Good evening. This is KPFK's dedicatory program. During the next hour and a half, you will hear samples of the station's broadcast schedule and an introduction to listener subscription radio.
Jean Marin was one of the original staffers in July 1959.
It was just at the beginning of what came to be known as the Great McCarthyite UAC witch hunt years, which KPFA had to suffer through for its first 10 years, and which very much affected the atmosphere. Northern California, however, is a place that is less susceptible to that sort of hysteria than most of the country. When the ACLU, for instance, banned communists at that time from its board of directors, the Northern California branch of ACLU disaffiliated itself in protest. So KPFA existed in a different place. When we went to KPFK, a lot of the witch hunt was wearing off, but we had the benefit of the experience 10 years before, so that before we went on the air, we made a point of trying to reach out to various parts of the community without making any attempt to disguise the fact that we intended to present all points of view, but at the same time, to make the argument that this is what we should be doing and that we had no intention of excluding points of view that were more conservative or more to the right. And we succeeded in getting a great deal of community support in advance before we went on. The Chandler family in Los Angeles, which was then a very conservative force, the Los Angeles Times at that time was not the paper it is now, ran editorials supporting us. There were still almost no FM stations, and there was no public television. There was no public radio. So we were really still something very, very different in the United States, much more so than now.
Marine was, in fact, hired by General Manager Terry Drinkwater and his associate John Harris, both of whom later left KPFK for mainstream news, but not before leaving their prints on the KPFK's style of programming.
Terry went on to be a CBS newscast. John Harris went on to be the assignment director for CBS television in Los Angeles a few years later. However, they began the thing, and Terry had great journalistic ambitions, and he hired me, actually, and gave me my job. He himself wanted very much to do an interview with notorious right-winger named Gerald L. K. Smith. In the first place, would establish us as certainly willing to put somebody besides lefties on the air. But the principal problem we had was with highly organized Jewish community in Los Angeles, and it became rather funny because the interview lasted 2 hours. The first thing that Gerald L. K. Smith said was that organized Jews will not allow you to broadcast this, and they indeed were going to boycott us and send out letters and do everything. A certain group was. I don't mean all the Jews in Los Angeles or anything like that, but certain organized groups. We finally persuaded them to come down and listen to the program, and they wound up calling up everybody and telling them to listen.
Another battle fought and won, recalls Marine, was his show on the controversial high-profile death penalty case of Carol Chessman, which won Marine the George Foster Peabody Award for Excellence in Broadcasting. Bob Trotter, a professor of music at UCLA, joined the staff as music director, and reporter Ed Cray used the airwaves to showcase his own folk music. With a staff so steeped in news hounds, it's no wonder that by the end of the first year, KPFK is credited with having formatted the first half-hour news show in radio.
When we first put on a half-hour news program, which was in very late 59, the news community, reporters from newspapers, stuff, you know, were extremely impressed, and they used to call us up to find out stuff. And for a short time, we had the highest ratings between 6 and 6:30 p.m. of any radio station, AM or FM, because we had the only half-hour news program, and it was uninterrupted. what had happened actually was that Terry and John Harris had already had contacts inside CBS television, and we knew that the CBS news department, which then had only Douglas Edwards' 15-minute news programming, they wanted very much to try a half-hour news show. The sales department and the business people at CBS said nobody would ever go for more than 15 minutes of news. So, believe it or not, so what we did was put in, we took out the old radio rip-and-read wire, we used to call it, and put in an Associated Press A-wire, both at KPFA and KPFK, for which they gave us for a very low price. And so then we had the standard news wire instead of the radio wire. And we were able to use that and do a full, uninterrupted half hour. And this attracted a great deal of attention, and our success, I believe, I was told, helped to convince the CBS people that maybe they could do a half hour news, and the rest is history.
The novelty of FM radio made it convenient for programmers to experiment outside the box. Marine says in 1959, just playing Mozart on the air was enough to get us attention. But the programming had become a lot more risque than classical music. He remembers a controversial young commentator named Dorothy Healy who hit the airwaves with a splash, causing some in the government to see red.
I was ultimately able, for example, to put Dorothy Healy on the air because we had demonstrated our willingness to put all different points of view, not just left ones. But she became very popular. At that time, I followed the what had been the original KPFA practice. We did not identify the commentators except by name because this was the practice on commercial radio. You didn't say who Raymond Graham Swing was or Gabriel Heater or any of those famous people. You just gave their names. So we would do the same thing, but Dorothy immediately identified herself as a leader of the Communist Party. And, you know, nobody cared. She became one of the most popular people of the year.
In 1962, when women's history profiles of Dorothy Healy and Elizabeth Gurley Flynn were broadcast, KPFK began making the headlines. The government charges Pacifica as communist infiltrated and withholds the license renewals of KPFA and KPFK, pending an investigation into the network's communist affiliations. Pacifica was ultimately never cited in any of the investigations. Conflict, both internal and external, for Pacifica is inevitable, says Marine. Lou Hill founded the station in 1949, and by 1951 he was out, only to return in 1952. Marine advises those rewriting the bylaws to be clear about what they want Pacifica to be today.
Really, somebody has to decide just exactly what do you want Pacifica to be. And, you know, I've been reading arguments and articles and whatnot, and I keep running into things like, you know, a voice of the left. You want it to be a voice of the left? Fine. Community radio station, community-oriented. You want it to be community-oriented? Fine. That was not what we were. What we were was a station to which you subscribed. We did not have members. We did not use, we avoided, like a plague, the word member. The members have votes. The New Yorker magazine does not have members. It has subscribers. The concept was that we would put out a professional product with professionals or people trained by professionals to produce in public affairs all points of view, to produce music that was not available in broadcasting elsewhere, to produce drama and literature not available elsewhere, to produce children's programming better than what you would get on Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy. And we would put this out, and if you liked it, you would subscribe. It was not, we will put out what you want to hear. And so it was intended to be subscribed to. It was not intended to be dictated to or voted on. And, you know, I think that we did a hell of a good job at this. I think it required dedication and really love of what we were doing and a profound belief that all points of view must be heard. And that includes the right wing and the left wing and the medium wing and the feet and the tail. And if you have people who believe that and who are tough and who are good and who are professional, then we believe enough people will subscribe. And enough people did for a while.
Marine admits the original system left many people feeling left out of the format, but he maintains that professionals should be allowed to make decisions about the broadcast. WBAI 99.5 FM. 1 year after KPFK's maiden broadcast, Pacifica's reach extends to the East Coast. A gift from philanthropist Louis Schweitzer, the station was welcomed onto the airwaves by then-Governor Nelson Rockefeller, Mayor Robert Wagner Jr., and Attorney General Louis Lefkowitz. In keeping with the Pacifica tradition of bodacious, innovative, in-your-face programming, WBAI was the first station to air the expose of J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI. Carolyn Goodman is the widow of Pacifica Board President Robert Goodman and a former WBAI lab chairman. When Bob died suddenly in 1969 of a brain hemorrhage, Carolyn felt it her duty to fulfill her husband's mission at Pacifica and became vice president of the foundation. Today, she recalls the candidness of the early days of WBAI programming.
What stands out in my mind is the openness and the honesty in the fact that when there were people who were interviewed on the air, there wasn't the kind of censorship that you would find. For example, even on places like public radio, that people could say what was on their minds. And, of course, there were times they said things that perhaps shouldn't have been said on the air or used language, and we got into trouble about that. I think that, and of course the listeners were self-selective, but there were a wonderful group of people, both the listeners and the programmers, and programs were exciting, and all different kinds of programs, whether it was music, whether it was drama, whether it was current affairs, and I can't give you the names of the programs, but I can tell you that it was pretty exciting to listen to. Just as today, and there was a time, as I don't have to tell you, in a not too long ago past, when the station was pretty darn boring.
2 years after the station was on the air, Pacifica was training volunteers to travel south for coverage of the awakening of the civil rights movement. Bob and Carolyn Goodman had three sons, and Andrew was among the trainees going south.
Andy was really the most political of the three boys, and he was at Queens College when Aaron Henry and Fannie Lou Hamer came and asked for volunteers to go to Mississippi. So he came home and said, Mom, he had to get our permission because he wasn't 21. He was only 20, and unless you were 21, you had to get your parents' permission. And, you know, I really gulped a lot of times. But how could we have raised our kids and lived the way we did and been activists from the time we were in college? That's how I met my husband. We were organizing farmers in Ithaca at Cornell. That's how we met. And so were we going to say to our son, well, you know, it sounds good to talk about it, but, I mean, doing it. No way. But I knew, we both knew, we all knew how dangerous it was to go down south. But, of course, we let him go. So down he went. He went out to Ohio. To Oxford, Ohio, to learn all what they learned out there, and then drove down to Mississippi much before they were finished with their training, because the church burned, and he went down with Mickey Schwerner and James Chaney, and he wasn't there for 24 hours before he was murdered. I mean, not 24 hours. So, it's the kind of pain that, well, it's always.
Yeah.
And for anybody who ever lost a child, it's always there. But it's the kind, for me, that has helped me to go on. It sounds strange, I think, doesn't it?
The Goodman-Schwerner-Cheney case is a pivotal part of civil rights history. In 1965, while America was at war with Vietnam, the first reporter to cover the war from North Vietnam was WBAI reporter Chris Koch. And 4 years later, Pacifica was the only news organization willing to break Seymour Hersh's story of the My Lai massacre, exposing the atrocities committed by the U.S. troops in Vietnam. A couple of years later, Carolyn takes a liking to another young Goodman in the WBAI scene, station manager Ed Goodman.
Ed Goodman is the only son of a very wealthy family who had a big place in New York City called Bergdorf Goodman. Bergdorf Goodman is no longer in business, but it was one of the most upscale department stores on Fifth Avenue. And he went to college with a man by the name of Paul Gorman. And Paul Gorman was a staff person at Pacifica, at WBAI. And he recommended Ed for a job. And Ed was a bit of a maverick, and he had been working with a man by the name of Ramsey Clark at the time. And we were looking for a manager, and Paul said, "I think I have someone for you. His name is Ed Goodman," and I didn't know who he was. So he came to my house, and I was the chair of BAI at the time. So this man came in, and I said, and he didn't tell me who he was, but I liked him immediately. He was exceptionally bright. And I said, "Well, I don't know who you are, but I hope you don't get mixed up because we have the same name. But and I should tell you that we don't pay very much." He said, "Well, sounds very interesting, and I'd like the job." And it was the time of Attica, prison rising.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So he took the job. And it was shortly afterwards that he went to prison, Ed Goodman. He went to prison because he refused to give up the tapes. We had taped the Attica uprising. And the house, I don't forget who it was, wanted the tapes because they could tell from the voice who were some of the leaders there. Ed refused to give up the tapes, so he went to prison. He went to the Men's House of Detention, New York.
Of the United States of America. First of all, we want it to be known that in the past we have had some very, very treacherous experiences with the Department of Correction in New York State. They have promised us many things, and they have given us nothing except more of what we already got. Brutalization, murder inside this penitentiary. We do not intend to accept or allow ourselves to accept this situation again.
Ed Goodman currently works for the Milestone Venture Partners. Carolyn Goodman advises the bylaws revisionist that risk-taking is an integral part of Pacifica's rich history and seems to urge them to avoid the mundane.
I think it's bound to happen when you have creative artists working in under certain kinds of stress, whether it has to do with economic, whether it has to do with political or other kinds of stress. It's bound to occur. You're in a... It's like putting a pot of water on the stove, and when you turn the heat up, you get, you know, all kinds of, you get it boiling, and out of it comes creativity, but also comes a certain explosion, you know, at times. And it's like everything else. You're taking risks, you're taking chances, and you... Some good comes out of it, and sometimes you get into trouble. That's the risk of Pacifica. It always was.
I was the homosexual guy that was going to get all the queers in trouble.
KPFT co-founder Ray Hill. When KPFT 90.1 FM went on the air as the fourth Pacifica sister station in Houston, Texas in February of 1970, it was a dream come true for Larry Lee and Dave Gardner. Ray Hill had helped to raise the transmitter money through a direct mail campaign. But unlike the auspicious opening day of WBAI, KPFT's maiden year was less than cordial. The station was bombed off the air twice by the Ku Klux Klan. The mission was to bring in the voices of all those excluded from Houston's mainstream media. They did outreach to African American, Hispanic, and women's groups. Hill remembers driving around in a pickup truck with a megaphone, informing people that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was coming to Houston. The mainstream media had refused to cover the story.
You don't really understand how extreme media exclusion can be until you think of a little bit earlier in the 60s, Dr. Martin Luther King came to Houston and there was a news blackout prior to his coming. We couldn't even get an announcement on primarily black commercial radio stations that Dr. King was coming, because the establishment here didn't want news that this black radical person was coming into Houston and would draw a crowd and create a rabble. And so to promote Dr. King's coming, we had to get in pickup trucks with sound systems and drive up and down black neighborhoods in Houston making the announcement over amplifier, and several of us got arrested for doing that because police got us for operating sound equipment without a permit. But that's what it's like to live in a media-controlled environment where your voice is simply not going to be heard.
Hill is currently a programmer on KPFT, host of the popular Prison Show. In a city where inmates are denied basic telephone privileges, Hill's show fills a huge void, providing a public service in the truest sense.
That radio show is as well known as it is, not because of anything that I do. It's because of those very compelling voices of lovers, fathers, mothers and grandmothers, mostly women's voices and a lot of children's voices. You see, when you're in prison, you don't get to hear children's voices.
Hill has had to toe the line over the years, opting to self-censor his show rather than face the wrath of managers.
I conformed to the demands of keeping my programming in line so that it didn't jeopardize the service I provide prison families.
And what did that mean, keeping your program in line?
Well, no one ever said, don't do this or don't do that, but I avoided angering the political establishment. I toned down, it was very subtle kind of censorship, I toned down my own editorial voice. I was still able to do the story of the director of prison taking bribes and giving bribes to feed inmates unedible meat substitutes. Incidentally, he has that story later hit the major media after 9 months on the Prison Show, and he has been convicted of 8 federal felonies and is awaiting sentencing now. So I was able to accomplish some good journalist purpose during that period. But I was constantly looking over my shoulder, and every time I turned on those microphones, I was careful not to offend.
Mm-hmm.
Because I didn't think station would back me up.
Hmm. Contrary to the early days.
Contrary to the Lou Hill principle that we do the hard stuff here. And I am so much more comfortable in today's atmosphere at KPFT.
Hill says there were times, however, when things looked pretty bleak.
Well, we almost lost it. And it had relative it, meaning the whole concept, the whole principle, the whole Lou Hill dream of Pacifica Foundation from the inception. And I don't think it had a great deal to do with KPFT. It had to do with some very valuable assets called WBAI and KPFA. Having frequency positions in the commercial band. And that I saw over a period of years, an evolutionary movement of the structure of Pacifica decision-making process some of us had seen that coming for a decade. I became general manager at KPFT in 1980. And an organization called NFCB, the National Federation of Semi-Commercial Broadcasters, came into KPFT and Pacifica Live with some ideas that we would be more successful if we would homogenize our message.
Hill says the political climate in the station today is very comfortable. Now he's back doing the hard stuff and having a good time. He has some advice, however, for those in the throes of bylaws revisions.
And I would advise all of those who love Pacifica, remember that there are principles that are more important than majority vote decisions. And those principles deal with the freedoms to hear and consider minority ideas. I would much rather hear some idea on my own beloved Pacifica radio station that I absolutely oppose, so that I don't run the risk of not getting my ideas that others oppose silenced. We're in the business of making people uncomfortable, because comfortable people do not change their attitudes, do not change the things that they do. But if you're going to be an activist, and I consider myself not only an activist but an accomplished one, you're going to have to go out there and make some people uncomfortable so that they will reconsider the position they are in. And in the process, you're going to have to hear their anger and their frustration that their ideas are being challenged. But it is incumbent on Pacifica Foundation, as in no other institution that I know of, to take those ideas and make sure that we make people think about their comfortable, easy, unexamined positions, so that change can happen in a society which can only remain vital if it keeps change in frequent occurrence.
Hill, the only station founder still involved in the operations of KPFT, has very specific views on the democratization process.
I don't think that you can have a Pacifica station in Houston or Washington or New York or San Francisco or Los Angeles or wherever without depending upon the good graces and commitment of the community. But if programming becomes a process of democratic decision, so that people with minority and unpopular ideas are not heard, then we fail at the mission that Lou Hill and all of our predecessors had envisioned for us to have. For instance, I began gay and lesbian, transgendered, and bisexual programming on KPFT in 1975. If you had taken a vote of the board, local board of KPFT, they would have voted against having such a show on the air. I began doing prison program in 1980. My board, I was manager at the time, and my board told me that I shouldn't do that kind of broadcasting. We have to have the courage to protect the voices of people that are not heard at all. And that is not a process that lends itself well to a democratic decision-making process in programming.
Hill believes one of the wonderful things about Pacifica is that it can self-examine. If Pacificans cannot gather, discuss, disagree, and argue, says Hill, then we're in an unnatural state. It's those arguments, disagreements, and debates that refine our purpose and direction. And it's very healthy, he says, not just for our mission as purveyors of liberty in broadcasting, but it is important for our nation and indeed the world. WPFW 89.3 FM.
That first broadcast began significantly with Ellington's Take the A Train, and was a proud moment, a moment of great relief, it's fair to say, because of all the difficulties we'd had getting to that point.
Grigsby Hubbard, a fourth-generation Quaker, was one of the founders of the network's then only African-American managed station.
So, conveyed by people who were part of that early effort, many of whom, most of whom, it's fair to say, aren't around any longer. But clearly from the beginning, there was an express purpose of bringing the Pacifica signal to this community of Washington, D.C., specifically being well aware of the need for greater expression for the African-American community. It's what figures prominently in this story is the fact that there was no black-controlled radio in the nation's capital when Pacifica began this effort. And it was very much a part of the express purpose to make it an expression of this community.
Now, when you say an expression of the community, was it to be a political expression of the community, a musical expression, a cultural expression, or
well,
what kind of expression?
Somewhat unique. That gets into my own notion that everything is at root political. You know, we can introduce some false dichotomies in there. It's fair to say that just in being rooted in the community and being in and of this community by the people of this community, it was very much in concert with the foundational principles of Pacifica, every bit of the format. There was clearly an emphasis on jazz music as really the sound of the kind of radical democracy that Pacifica is about, as being a part of the mix, but the mix from the beginning to encompass everything that you hear in the eclectic Pacifica sounds elsewhere. This was the first station with African-American manager and largely staffed by African-Americans from the very beginning and beginning in that jazz expression. But I, for one, don't appreciate the repeated implications that this is a thing apart from the kind of political expression that Pacifica is so associated with.
By the late 70s, Pacifica's reputation in Washington had preceded itself. The House Un-American Activities Committee, the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee, the FBI, the FCC were all fairly acquainted with Pacifica's politics. Just 2 years prior, the U.S. Supreme Court had heard the case against WBAI for airing comedian George Carlin's routine, Seven Dirty Words You Can't Say on Television. It was a landmark First Amendment case. Hubbard says doors were slamming in WPFW's face all over town.
There were times when it became clear that there were certain landlords who weren't going to rent to us at any price. There were a host of the kind of routine rebuffs, even beyond the, you know, the regulatory challenge and beyond the challenge of people learning to do something they'd never done before. But there were lots of people who told us in no uncertain terms that they didn't really want us to be here. It was not just the ordinary business of putting a radio station on the air. I mean, we came to anticipate lots of people expressing the opinion that what they knew of Pacifica was not something they wanted to hear here.
It would take a 7-year struggle to get the station on the air. Hubbard was not comfortable naming businesses who blacklisted the station, even 25 years after the fact. The opposition, according to Hubbard, took on some thinly veiled tactics.
There's that story, off told, but perhaps not told enough, of how we were a part of the beginning of black radio in this town, with standing aside so that HUR could begin. Howard was literally given a station by the Washington Post Company, Kay Graham. So that came ahead of us, and we figured prominently in all of how that came about, including contributing the first station manager there.
So was that an attempt to circumvent WPFW from coming on the air?
That's my thesis. I've expressed this before. I think clearly. There were lots of shifts in the whole radio market landscape that I think were directly attributable to the perceived threat of WPFW coming online.
Hubbard remembers racism as having been an obstacle from all sides, including the inside. But he's reluctant to give details, liking it to an emotional scab picking.
I've just got too many examples. These are stories that I wish the people could tell their own story. I wish I could tell the story more completely of what happened with WPFW, which I do not feel had adequate support from Pacifica from the very beginning. But that's a story more properly in the voice by the first manager, Greg Millard, who's also gone.
Hubbard says the indictment against the network is clear and extensive, but believes it's time now during the restructuring of the bylaws to be proactive. What's needed, Hubbard says, is a radical redesign that involves talking together without lapsing into shouting matches.
We can do better in the here and now, and we need to. And it's clearly the thing that gives, you know, a sense of instant renewal. I mean, people know as they've begun just in the last few months to hear more of what I think of as real Pacifica. They're just getting an appetizer, getting a taste of, you know, the reason why someone would do as I've done and just take, you know, literally years of time for something that is just strictly a volunteer effort that, you know, without any very immediate reward. But there is the immediate reward when you know that there's a possibility of people hearing the kind of programming that we get to hear now. And I'm witnessing now, of course, you know, most recently our programming heard only fitfully in Washington, D.C. on September 11th.
Grigsby Hubbard, co-founder of WPFW.
Pacifica at its worst is worth supporting. It's a unique institution, but we now face not just a special crisis, but a special time of opportunity for renewing this, really based on what it was set out to be at its foundation. And we're going to have to do this by having the crazy courage to get out of our own way and to function in a more civil way, working with one another. It's that important.
I'm Verna Avery Brown for Pacifica. Thank you for listening.
This special historic broadcast was engineered by Sidrack Franklin with technical assistance from Jim Bennett. Our music editor was Sean Rhodes. We had technical assistance from Christine Blasdale and Armando Guedino. Many thanks to Brian DeShazer and Maria Kim in the archives. The show was co-produced by Rob Robinson and Verna Avery Brown. Thanks for listening.
And that program was brought to you on recording here on 99.5 FM, listener-supported non-commercial Pacifica Radio, WBAI in New York City. It's 4:52, coming up at 5 o'clock, All Mixed Up with Peter Beauchamp, which will be taking place live from the Museum of Television Radio, but we'll get to that at 5 o'clock. In the meantime, I think we've got some announcements and some other recorded material. Stay tuned.
You're tuned to High Five, WBAI 99.5 on your FM dial, New York.
On Wall Street. Look sharp today, boys, especially your rookies. Next to the index, most of the money. I wish I kept staffing buying on the opening. Permits 1,000. Deal for sale of such a big boat, 350,000 before convenience. Get on the horn with your institution. Report on their appetite. It's all you tell us are our top priority today. Okay, let's go to.
This is WBAI FM. In New York.
I played a piece, a John Cage's, called WBAI. And so for me, WBAI is fixed in my mind as being a kind of progressive, intelligent, on the ball, witty area of broadcasting. And I guess certainly the conversation we've had just now seems to confirm that probably is the case.
This is Richard Belzer. Since the 1960s, when I wanted to be really informed, aside from the mainstream, I listened to WBAI. I got war news, I got news on the civil rights movement, I got copy from news sources that weren't generally used by the mainstream in America. It helped educate me and shape my thoughts, and I hope that you contribute and listen to this station because it's an important part of what America was supposed to be all about. Thank you.
Hi, this is Ben Gillette of Penn & Teller, and you're listening to WBAI, listener-supported radio.
In New York City.
Hi, this is Tony Bennett.
WBAI.
WBAI-FM.
The soundtrack of New York City.
WBAI Arts Magazine, Tuesdays, 2 to 3 p.m., featuring rhymers, mimers, and old rag timers, horn blowers and tapestry sewers, smart headlines and art deadlines, movie messiahs and art gallery pariahs. The WBAI Arts Magazine, Tuesdays at 2 p.m.
So please do be sure to tune in for that. It's a very fine program. Well, you're tuned to 99.5 FM WBAI in New York. We have a little time before 5 o'clock coming up at 5. All Mixed Up with Peter Beauchamp, coming to you live from the Museum of Radio and Television. But in the meantime, here's Johnny Johnson.
Now, I was walking down the street just the other day when two fine-looking women folks happened to walk my way. Now, one said, "Something stinks." The other one said, "You're right." Then I start slipping and sliding. And I know something wasn't right.
Stepping what?
Now everybody knows. They say the smell of the fellow. But everybody knows just what it is. Now there's some four-legged creature out playing on my mind. He's got a ham bone on his breast and evil in his hind. I'm gonna find myself a stick and scrape off these blues and go on down to the DAV and buy myself some shoes.
Step in what?
Everybody knows. They say smelling the fellas, but everybody knows just what it is. Carry me a roll of paper towels in my briefcase every night. Got me a can of Lysol too, and that makes everything right. And there's the same two women folks I just saw the other day, and they both got sticks scraping off their shoes with their heads turned the other way.
Step in what?
Now everybody knows. They say smell is a felon, but everybody knows just what it is. Now they say what goes around comes around, and I know that's got to be true. So don't you folks be laughing too hard, because next time it might be you. And if it ever happened to you, Well, that's really not a sin. And what's this I feel underneath my shoe? I done made that same mistake again.
Step in what? Step in what? Step in what?
Everybody knows. They say smell is a fella, but everybody knows just what it is. Everybody knows just what it is.